Blog Talk Radio.
Karen Cam Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam. And if you're joining us live, please feel free to call in to ask a question of our special guest. Today's call-in number is 818-514-1190. Again, 818-514-1190. And I'm so pleased to have our guest today. Her name is Dr. Deb Schwartz-Hirsharn. She's a PhD. She's been doing marriage counseling for a very, very long time. And her expertise, interestingly, for over 20 years, she's been researching the areas of verbal abuse and domestic violence. And her book, which I have a copy right in front of me, is called The Healing is Mutual, Marriage Empowerment Tools to Rebuild Trust and Respect Together. It's a beautiful book, and I highly recommend that you get a copy, and we'll tell you a little bit later in the show how you can get a copy of this. And Dr. Deb's work of years of couples counseling is going to be so helpful for my listeners. I know a lot of you out there that are into relationships, and many of you are single wanting to be in relationships. So even though you may be single, You know, don't tune out just because we're talking about marriage, because what you can learn on this show is going to help you in your future relationship as well. So without further ado, Dr. Deb, hello and welcome to our show.
Hi, Dr. Karen. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you, and it's a wonderful book you've written and really so 100% totally resonates with the kind of work that I do, and I really, really love counseling people on their relationships. And you have some pretty neat expertise in the area of domestic violence, verbal abuse, and, of course, marriage counseling. So how did you decide to write a book like this? Like, what prompted you to create this piece of work?
Actually, a friend of mine said, you ought to put all your stories together into a book. Really, that was the origin of my book. I was working in a particular person's office. I had my own clients there, and he was always trying to help me with advice, and that's what he did. So at that time, this was before there was such a thing as blogs. And we just, posted articles up to the website, and I had actually learned HTML, and I had written all these articles.
Wow.
I pulled them together, and that was the earlier version of the book, and all the chapters didn't really hang together too well because they were just a whole bunch of just different stuff. So I kind of rewrote it, and I pulled it together, and I added stories and examples and, little things that people could do on their own to help make it make sense to them personally, called my toolboxes. And that's what I did.
Oh, that's good. Well, and if people that know me well know I'm really into tools.
Right.
And it's wonderful how you've outlined, you've got them in beautiful blocks, in your book. This is tool number, and it's great because you can really quickly, after you've read the whole book even, just go back and go, oh, right, I have this tool. Okay, I can do this. And I love having empowerment tools for people. So congratulations for doing that.
Thank you. I feel the same way as you. I think we're really on the same page. You can only get it when you do it.
Exactly. So my first question for you about your book and about your work is that it seems to me that many people enter marriage in a state of woundedness. So they attract a partner in a similar state of woundedness. Maybe not necessarily the same kinds of wounds, but vibrationally, a similar state of woundedness. So after the honeymoon ends, then what we find is old patterns start to rear their ugly heads. And although I don't judge divorce necessarily as a bad thing anymore, I used to, which is why I had such a hard time ending my first marriage until I healed that belief. But your book talks about how marriage can be an opportunity to heal oneself within the marriage. Can you share
right.
with our listeners what you mean by this?
Well, let me just start out by saying that if a person is fighting and two people are not getting along, when you divorce, what you're doing is bringing that fight to court. And now, whatever the neediness was, whatever your unmet needs were from your marriage, you're certainly not going to get them met because in court, that's just not going to happen. But people fight as if they thought they could somehow, quote, win, unquote, and you don't win in court. All you do is inflict wounds, it's payback. And people will find that that doesn't make them heal, it doesn't make them happy, it doesn't make them feel better, and those unmet needs are still unmet. So if two people are going to divorce, I still feel they need to work on healing what is troubling them in their marriage first. Even if they're going to divorce, because then you can have an amicable divorce with the unmet needs not as an issue anymore. It's resolved. It's resolved because once a person feels validated by the other person, you needed me to really be there for you, and I never was, and you know what? I don't think I have it in me, and I'm so sorry. I don't have it in me to be there for you because your needs are not something I can fill. Well, now you have a different kind of a conversation. There's a healing process right in that conversation. So if you can get, if a couple can get to a place where they can have a conversation like that, then maybe they can divorce in a healthy way. So it's not that I'm against divorce, but I'm all for healing, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a perfect, you know, perfect example of what happened with myself and my first husband is that I realized that I was really being a people pleaser all my life because I kind of learned that. And so I was trying to be who he wanted me to be. And it's so funny because we had this running joke, which I still think is kind of funny, but where, you know, I was trying to be this hardy mountain woman, you know, that he wanted. He wanted to live out a homestead and grow all our food and all this kind of stuff. And here I was, you know, a city girl princess. So there was this running joke about how, you know, I was trying to be this mountain woman and I have pictures of myself, you know, all buff from like hewing logs and stuff like that. Well, I burnt myself out completely physically, mentally, emotionally. And what I realized was that I really didn't honor who I was. And so when I started to do that, I couldn't actually be the person he really wanted me to be. And so I said, I can't do that anymore. I'm sorry.
Right.
And so, you know, we went to this place of understanding that we were just really, really different. And it was so healing to be able to honor how each of us were who we were, that there was nothing wrong with each of us, but that if we really wanted to be who we really wanted to be, that it wasn't appropriate for us to stay married. And I think that yeah, I mean, it was just so wonderful to be able to get to that healing point in
exactly.
a divorce.
Exactly. That's my point. You've got it right on the nail. Right. That is
well,
my point.
Yeah, that and well, and so many people, as you of course know, they think, okay, well, there's something wrong with that person, so I got to divorce them and find somebody better. And that's not
very,
you know, what you're saying in this book.
No, that's really judgmentalism. And of course, we all make judgments. It's normal to, you know, kind of think, well, how do I feel about that person? What do I think of their capabilities or their intellect or their kindness or lack thereof? But we have to reduce the amount of judgment that we pass on other people and give them a little more leeway to be who they are and a little benefit of the doubt for why they act the way they do. And I think that's part of the healing process, too. If you're not going to get divorced, I think we have to start working on giving each other the benefit of the doubt a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
That's something
absolutely.
You might have seen it. I've got exercises on that in the book, so it's important. It's an important piece.
Well, I'm going to skip to this other area of your expertise when it comes to domestic violence and verbal abuse, but specifically on verbal abuse. So, you know, I want to tell you a story that I remember in my first marriage. You know, my husband and I had kind of pet names for each other, and I was known as several different nicknames that at the time I thought were endearing. Why? Because my dad said similar kinds of nicknames for my mother, and she would, you know, repeat them herself, and so I did the same thing. And, you know, things like doofus or princess and the pea. I mean, there were some of the ones that I was called klutz, sucky poo, you know. And then after I got divorced and when I was dating another man who happened to be a psychologist, interestingly, he pointed out that he felt really uncomfortable with these terms. He felt they were derogatory.
Right.
And it was the first time that I realized, oh, my gosh, I didn't see them as that because that's what I grew up with. I thought they were funny. And my mother even makes, you know, jokes. She calls them jokes on Susan. You know, makes jokes about herself all the time. And I started feeling really really uncomfortable with them as well. And I shared them with her, you know, I really don't feel good when you put yourself down like this. But it was really interesting how in your book you really talk about how this, you know, name-calling or what you call put-downs are actually really harmful. So can you tell us more about your thoughts on that?
So your mother actually got convinced somehow that that's who she was and that's how she could handle the jokes. And in her mind, she probably created a little corner of her mind where she could say, well, I'm good at X, Y,
right,
and Z. And so if I'm all these other bad things, at least X, Y, and Z I can hold dear to me. But the fact of the matter is that nobody has a right to call you names. No one has a right. You know, it's labeling. It's saying this is who you are. So not only the X, Y, and Z that she is reserving for herself as being good, but the A, B, and C that he is using as your father as a joke become part of who she is in his mind, those people who hear its mind and her own mind, and actually, is that really who she is? It's like robbing her of her identity. It's taking his view of who she is and making that her identity. And I very much think that that's a loss both to her because it's not allowing her to be who she is in all areas, but to him as well, because he's taking these areas that he is using these names in and not recognizing what's there in these areas that's good and valuable as his partner. So he's losing out as well. My position, and that's why the word mutual is in the title of my book and together, because it's both people gain from the healing and both people lose if they don't.
Yes, I see that. I see that. And, you know, what's really interesting is that, you know, my current partner now, he'll catch me sometimes still, you know, putting down myself and then, you know, and I'll catch myself and I realize, wow, that really feels different in my body. That's a lower vibration.
Yeah.
I'm literally pulling my vibration down, the opposite of healing, and that doesn't feel good. And so I think, you know, so many of us get so used to putting ourselves down as a form of humor that it becomes like a habit, like everybody does it. You know, oh, I'm such a klutz, or oh, I'm, you know, I must have Alzheimer's. I'm, you know, my memory's like crap, or you know, just putting themselves down all the time. And you know, what you're saying in your book is that, you know, these so-called little things that people think they do are really quite harmful, especially
very
accumulated
much
over long periods of time.
Very much.
Well, I really,
because as I say, the
more
you
really
say things,
it.
It's there's a circuit in your brain that keeps traveling through that same path. You're saying it, it becomes part of who you think you really are. And the more you do it, that's your identity. And one of the tools in my book to undo that is not just to stop, but to substitute something that's positive about yourself and true that you keep saying in place of these things. And you have to say it a lot to counteract so that when you hear something that might have gotten you down the wrong path, you can reverse it and you can go down this correct path of uttering the statement that's positive about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, it's I used to tell people that I'm a terrible cook, and what I realized is that it wasn't that I was a terrible cook. I wasn't that interested in cooking. It's a big difference.
There you go.
That
perfect.
If I really wanted to be a really great cook, I could learn to be. Okay, maybe not
of
so
course.
Natural as some other people, but and so I stopped saying that, or at least trying to remember to stop saying that, and just say instead, well, I prefer not, you know, I prefer have somebody else cook. I say, well, it's not that I'm a horrible cook. It's just that I don't prefer to cook. I'd rather somebody cook for me because I really love eating.
There you go.
Smart
woman.
So more true.
Smart woman. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, I just came home now from a training exercise where I just work out with a trainer, and I don't think that I have a great sense of my body in space and how I move and so on and so forth. But I'm not going to say I'm a klutz. That's just not helpful. How am I going to become better
right.
at it? In my own mind, I'm saying, what a great experience. I'm learning to be really strong and powerful. Because that's what I want to be.
Yeah,
so,
that's
yeah.
great. And I can see you in my mind, too, Dr. Deb, at the gym. I mean, well, you know, one of the things I really appreciated in your book was this discussion about the difference between being sensitive and being victimized. So I think, you know, this is very valuable. So I was hoping you could share with some of our listeners, like, what is the difference, and maybe give us some examples.
Well, I have a whole chapter, and then I come back to it on victim thinking. My origin of this concept is that I totally believe that, let's say, a person out there is being put down, they're in an abusive marriage, or they don't even realize to call it abusive. They just feel hurt sometimes by the words that are used against them. The person who's doing that, the one who is using those words, that person probably was mistreated himself or herself growing up. And that person thinks of himself or herself as a victim. So what is the best defense when you feel like you're being victimized? It's a good offense. And that's how some people become abusive, because they think they're defending themselves. They really do. They feel perpetually like victims. So if someone's feelings are hurt, the first thing they have to do is really carefully assess where the other person was coming from. Did that person mean to hurt them, or was it a misunderstanding, or was it them taking it wrong and being a victim because all their life that's exactly what they were? Now, they might find that their feelings were hurt because something was truly said to them that was hurtful, like you're a klutz. Okay, so now the question is, okay, this was not playing victim, it's real, they were spoken to in a hurtful way. So are they being sensitive, and are they being appropriately sensitive, or what's going on? I happen to think sensitivity is a very good thing. I feel that I myself couldn't be a therapist and be helpful to people if I weren't able to sense how they feel. That sensitivity is an outreach kind of a thing. You're sensing your environment. You're feeling what's going on with people and with, you know, the incoming vibes. So sensitivity is a good thing. So when a person feels bad because they were hurt, I think they should. But again, they have to be sure that they really were hurt and not that they were playing victim in their own mind. And there are a lot of tools in the book to help them figure that out, because that one isn't easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. I remember growing up, you know, hearing, you know, my dad saying to my mom, oh, just don't be so sensitive. And she was incredibly sensitive. You know, I think that there were times where, yeah, she sensed something in someone's voice or, you know, read into something. And then other times where it was totally expanded out of proportion based on her past experience that it wasn't really real. So that was her being a victim when she didn't have to be.
Right,
so
she's
both sensitive, but also, you know, sometimes feeling victimized because of past experiences.
Well, one thing I would say, based on what you were telling me and your audience about your mom, is that she was sensitive because she was hurt so much and wanted to make little of that. In other words, those remarks that she thought were a joke were still hurting her. They went into her soul, and they did damage there. She wasn't conscious of that, but they did damage there. And so she was hurting badly. And when you're hurt badly, I mean, let's say you burnt yourself, you know that even running ordinary tap water, like room temperature, over that burn will hurt. So that's where her sensitivity came from, because she wasn't healed. Does that make sense?
Right. Absolutely. And so, you know, the gift of it, of course, is that she worked with young children in the classroom. And so she was the teacher that everybody loved
because she was so sensitive. Yes,
she was so
beautiful.
Sensitive, so kind. Yeah, all the children that, you know, were abused at home and, you know, were just a handful ended up in her classroom because she could handle them. She could love them for the soul that they were, and they behaved for her.
Because they felt that love. Beautiful. And that is the way to heal. That's part of the healing. When someone mistreats you, I'm not saying take it, but I'm saying understand where it comes from. And I've got many, many, many examples in the book, but just to illustrate one example, if I were called a doofus, I might say, so for you, these words are just a joke. And for other people who realize the meaning of these words, they're actually put downs. So please don't do that to me anymore. If you want a joke, let's figure out what could work. But that wouldn't be one of them. That's how I would handle that.
Nice. Now that sounds great. Well,
and that's part of healing. It's part of healing your dad too, because it's not being disrespectful to him. It's recognizing that he didn't know better. And he was just doing it because he thought it was okay. And it's true. He shouldn't be put down just because she was. A lot of women think that if they have been put down, it gives them the right to go and sling it back. And it doesn't.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I have some patients and women in my practice who, you know, tell me, because I have more, you know, women in my practice, about, 80-20%.
Yeah.
Why, you know, what can I do if I'm interested in healing the marriage and I'm, you know, willing to read these books and make these changes, but my partner is not interested at all? I'm sure you get this question quite a bit.
Oh, how
do you?
By the way, I just saw a movie that really, really, really illustrates that. It was a fun movie. Maybe it was hard for some people to see. I don't know. But I thought it was a good movie. It's called Hope Springs. Just putting a plug. Nobody paid me for it. But, the guy was like that. He had no interest. So let me tell you something. No interest means fear. The real English translation is, I don't care, it's I'm afraid. That's the truth. Mm. So the woman who is used to looking inside herself, in a way she's comfortable with her fears and her anxieties. Not that she likes them, but she's used to them. She knows they're there. She's aware of them. In our society, men are not allowed to have fears and anxiety. So what do you do if you're afraid and you're not allowed to be? You can't just accept it. You have to pretend it doesn't exist and pretend there's no problem. When they say they're not interested, it really means they're afraid, and they're afraid of acknowledging that they're afraid. So I think a partner who recognizes that needs to be very firm and say, I get it, you don't want to come, I'm going. And I do this, by the way, all the time. I tell women, come in alone, let's talk, and then tell your spouse that the therapist wants your opinion on this, or the therapist wants to meet you to see what your ideas are. It's so simple, because then they feel like they're coming in as an advisor rather than that there's something wrong with them. And,
oh,
of course,
I love
the
that.
Therapist has to know how to handle that very, very well. If they come in and the therapist starts finger-pointing and saying, well, you shouldn't do this, forget it. They're out of there. They're gone. They're done. So you can't do that. With the book, I think women could do the same thing. Well, I'd like you to read the book and tell me if you think that there's something that in here that we could use that's useful. That's very benign. As long as it's done in a non-frightening way, because I am telling you, if they keep in mind, your listeners, that the key problem is the men are afraid, then they can kind of devise a way to get them to start reading the book.
Ah, that's beautiful. I am memorizing this line.
Okay.
That is good. That's great. Thank you so much. Well, for the 3 minutes we have left, I want to make sure people know how to get a copy of your book and how they can connect with you.
Well, the best thing for them to do now is to text the following number, text to this number, their email address and their first name. Okay, so the phone number is 516-628-6077. Text their own name and email to that address. And what will happen is they will be able to get a little ebook that I have created, which will be free for them. And I will send them back a link to download that. And meanwhile, that keeps them in touch with me. So that's a way
Can
get something nice for listening to the program and also to keep them informed so that when the book is going to launch, I'll let them know exactly what the details are. It was supposed to be September, and I've actually moved it to November to give more people like your audience a chance to find out about it. So there's plenty of time, but in the meantime, they'll get the free ebook.
Oh, that's great. Now, what's the name of the ebook? Because I think people would love to know that.
Okay, Signs Your Marriage Needs Help and What to Do About It. I've got like 18, I think. If this is happening, then this is the solution. If this is happening, this is the solution. And it's like 18 things, 18 chapters, but it's short.
Fabulous.
It's very short, to the point. It's just a little sample of, you know, it's about 40 pages, but it's a little sample of what's in the big book.
Oh, that's great. So the number again, if you could tell our audience again, Dr. Deb.
Are you there?
Can you hear me now? Dr. Deb? Oh, I think we lost Dr. Deb here. But Well, how about can we say the number again?
Yes.
So people can text their email or name too.
516-628-6077.
Great. Oh, that's fabulous. What a great way to do it. Now, if someone's from out of country that wanted to stay connected to you, where would they find you or more information about the book?
I think they can still do it to that phone number. I don't know how exactly the dialing process goes, but they can also just go to drdeb.com and they could sign up for my newsletter, and I have videos they get and so forth. So that might be an alternative.
Ah, fabulous. Well, that's all the time we have for today, everyone. Thank you so much, Dr. Deb, for your expertise. Absolutely wonderful book. Congratulations.
Thank you, Dr. Karen. Thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye, everyone. Until next time.